Good evening. It is 5 p.m. on Thursday, July 16th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents, your weekly roundup of the latest Limestone local news. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Coming up in today's episode, an update from the new Lunch by George downtown distribution site, after the organization made the move from their home of over 40 years at St. George's Cathedral. Some messages directly from the city, including an update on the 315 Queen Mary Road Shared Care Model opening, the announcement of the 2026 Rural Community Program Fund recipients, the opening of the new baseball diamond in Woodbine Park, and more. Plus, your weather and traffic report for this upcoming weekend, and a few events to keep on your radar from CFRC's events calendar. Without further delay, let's dive in. After 40 years serving Kingston residents experiencing food insecurity from St. George's Cathedral, Lunch by George has officially relocated to a new distribution site on Wellington Street. It was announced in November 2025 that Lunch by George, operated by independent nonprofit organization Outreach St. George's Kingston, would relocate from church premises by June 30, 2026. In the November release, St. George's Cathedral, quote, regretfully concluded that it no longer has the capacity to host the Lunch by George program from the church facility. The church went on to state, quote, over the years, as the number of unhoused people included many more with mental health challenges and drug dependencies, the nature of the program changed to require much greater security. This situation also began to impact the operations of the church and, more critically, the staff at St. George's. Over the past few months, local organizations, including St. Lawrence College, the City of Kingston, United Way, and the Community Foundation for Kingston and Area, came together to support the move to a new location and transition to a new distribution model. In the new model, launched at the end of June, meals are prepared in the teaching kitchen at St. Lawrence College and transported daily to the new downtown distribution site using a Mercedes-Benz Sprinter provided by Mercedes-Benz Kingston. I met with Tom Iveson, Chief Administrator with Outreach St. George's Kingston, at the new distribution site last week to discuss the transition. Well, to start us off, you've been operating under this new model for just over a week. How's the transition been so far?
Fabulous. It's gone better than what we had hoped and planned. Our volunteers love it. Our guests love it. We're right in person. Previously, we had a takeout window, and it was a barrier. And looking back in hindsight, whereas this is much more open and welcoming.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of partnerships behind the scenes making this happen. I was wondering if you could kind of paint a picture of how everyone's contributing here.
A lot of partnerships. I'm very thankful to the City of Kingston. I'd been in touch with my counterpart there, or an official, since last year. And she was instrumental in terms of reaching out to St. Lawrence College. We already had established a relationship with the United Way. We're an anchor agency. So they've been supportive. Mercedes-Benz Kingston has been fabulous as well.
And Iveson says more partners continue to be added to the list.
So we've had two new collaborations come together in the last week. One is the Community Foundation of Kingston and Area, which provided us a grant to help us move. But their team is going to spend a day volunteering up at the college with us. And secondly, the mayor's office reached out, and they have an event every year called Mayor for a Day, where a young person can be mayor. So we've partnered up for that, and they'll be donating goods for Lunch by George.
Wow, so even more partnerships than we're already there when this all came together.
I'm juggling a lot of balls every day. More and more just keep getting added in. But it's great. It's wonderful.
For sure. And what has it meant for you, for all these organizations, to really rally behind this program?
It's really rewarding and satisfying. We work hard. Our head cook works really hard. In June, we put out 5,366 meals between breakfast and lunch. That took a lot of work. So it's a tough job, but more than worth it.
And just a few weeks into operating under this new model, The Lunch by George team is already thinking about what comes next.
Moving forward, what are you thinking about and what are you hoping for in the next few months?
Once we get our feet going here, we'd like to explore a second location. So potentially we could do maybe one breakfast here, but two lunches somewhere else. And we're talking to other partners about how that may work.
A short message from Southeast Public Health this evening. Poor air quality continues in the Southeast Public Health region. Environment Canada continues to issue special air quality statements for parts of the region caused by wildfires in northwestern Ontario. Regularly check local weather forecasts and local air quality conditions using the Air Quality Health Index or special air quality statements. Everyone is at risk for health impacts related to poor air quality. However, health risks are greatest for infants and children, older adults, those living in high air pollution areas, people living with chronic illnesses such as asthma, diabetes, heart, or lung diseases, people who are pregnant, people who are underhoused or experiencing homelessness, people who work outdoors, or people participating in strenuous sports and outdoor activities. If you are experiencing symptoms such as increased coughing, throat irritation, headaches, or shortness of breath, Southeast Public Health recommends reducing or rescheduling strenuous outdoor activity until the air quality improves. As smoke levels rise, so do health risks. Take protective measures to protect yourself and others from the effects of wildfire smoke. Reduce or reschedule strenuous activities outdoors, especially if you experience symptoms such as coughing and throat irritation. When indoors, keep windows and doors closed as much as possible. Protect your indoor air from wildfire smoke. Precautions can include using a clean, high-quality air filter in your ventilation system and/or a certified portable air cleaner that can filter fine particles. If you must spend time outdoors, a well-fitted N95 mask or equivalent may help reduce your exposure to harmful fine particles. Masks can reduce your exposure to the fine particles in smoke, but do not reduce exposure to gases. Check on people who may be more vulnerable to poor air quality, such as older adults, young children, and people with existing health conditions. Watch for symptoms of smoke exposure. Mild and common symptoms of smoke exposure include sore and watery eyes, runny nose and sinus irritation, scratchy throat and mild coughing, and headache. Severe symptoms include shortness of breath, wheezing, severe cough, dizziness, chest pains, and heart palpitations. Seek medical attention if you develop severe symptoms. To learn more about the signs, symptoms, and health effects of poor air quality from wildfire smoke, visit southeastph.ca/airquality. Once again, that was a message directly from Public Health this evening. Before we get into more local news, let's take a look at your weather and traffic report for the rest of the week. Here's a look at traffic around Kingston for this evening and the days ahead. Starting with construction, expect lane reductions on King Street West between Country Club Drive and Front Road, while Utilities Kingston continues water and sanitary main work. Drivers can also expect delays on Bath Road between Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard and Portsmouth Avenue, as new pedestrian crossing signals are installed. Construction continues at the intersection of Montreal Street and John Counter Boulevard, with roadway and sidewalk repairs underway. Paving work also continues on Taylor Kidd Boulevard between Coronation Boulevard and Collins Bay Road. Moving to road closures, beginning today, Park Street at Toronto Street will be closed daily through August 13th, while crews install a new all-way stop. Baggett Street between Barrie and West remains closed through July 24th for the Eastern Canadian Little League Championship. John Street between Montreal Street and Baggett Street remains closed through July 31st for Utilities Kingston water and sanitary upgrades. Cranbrook Street between Lakeview Avenue and Days Road remains closed through the end of August for pedestrian improvements. South Bartlett Street between Victoria Street and Smith Street is closed through the end of September for facade restoration work. Norman Rogers Drive remains closed between Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard and Van Order Drive for roadway rehabilitation. Princess Street remains closed between Frontenac and Division as the city's major reconstruction project continues. Sydenham Street remains closed between Princess and Queen for the Sydenham Street community space. Wright Crescent remains closed between Palace Road and Kingsley Crescent for roadway repairs and traffic calming improvements. Aberdeen between Johnson Street and William Street remains closed for construction staging, and Barrie Street at Queen remains closed for construction activity at 283 Queen. Looking ahead to this weekend, on Sunday, July 19th, Ontario Street between the Tragically Hip Way and Highway 2, including the LaSalle Causeway, will be fully closed from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. for temporary opening of the Marine Navigation Channel. Also on Sunday, Ontario Street between Brock and Clarence will be closed from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. for the annual Pull Together for Epilepsy event. Now turning to your weather forecast for tonight and this weekend. Any lingering chance of showers early this evening will quickly move out, leaving partly cloudy skies before clearing overnight. Winds are gusting to 40 kilometers an hour and will ease off this evening, with an overnight low of 15 degrees. Friday is shaping up to be the nicest day of the weekend, with wall-to-wall sunshine and a high of 28 degrees. Friday night brings cloudy periods with a 30% chance of showers and a low of 16. Saturday looks a little more unsettled. Expect mostly cloudy skies with a 40% chance of showers and a high of 26 degrees. Saturday night brings mostly cloudy skies with a 30% chance of showers and a low of 14. By Sunday, conditions improve again with a mix of sun and cloud and a pleasant high of 27 degrees. Sunday night brings cloudy periods with a low of 15. This has been your traffic and weather report for this evening and headed into the weekend. Now let's turn back to more local news. Now diving into some messages directly from the city of Kingston. Starting off, city marks completion of Bay Ridge Drive transportation improvements. The city of Kingston officially marked the completion of major transportation improvements along Bay Ridge Drive with a ribbon-cutting ceremony yesterday, celebrating a safer, more connected corridor for people walking, rolling, cycling, and taking transit. The project delivers a continuous, all-ages and abilities active transportation route, improving connections between neighborhoods, transit, and local destinations, while enhancing safety for all road users. Mark Gerritsen, Kingston's Member of Parliament, states, quote, "Today's ribbon cutting marks an important milestone for safe and accessible transit options in Kingston. These improvements will ensure that residents have access to sustainable and efficient transit routes, while supporting healthier and more connected neighborhoods." Ian Semple, the City of Kingston Commissioner for Transportation and Infrastructure Services, says, quote, "Bay Ridge Drive is a key corridor in Kingston's active transportation network, and this project reflects the city's commitment to safer, more connected streets. These improvements respond directly to community feedback and give people of all ages and abilities more options to walk, roll, bike, and access transit." The Bay Ridge Drive corridor was first identified as a priority route in the city's Active Transportation Master Plan, with further direction provided through the Active Transportation Implementation Plan 2019 to 2023. With over $6.9 million in funding from the federal government's Investing in Canada Infrastructure Program, Public Transit Infrastructure Stream, the city expanded the project to enhance pedestrian, cycling, and transit connections along the corridor. A portion of the route from Coverdale Drive to Henderson Boulevard will also form part of the Great Lakes Waterfront Trail. Construction was completed in two phases starting in 2023 and finishing spring of 2026. Key improvements include dedicated off-road multi-use pathways and cycle tracks, providing protected space for people walking and biking, intersection upgrades including bike signals, cross rides, and protected intersection safety features, and island bus platforms and transit shelters to improve access to Kingston Transit Service. Community-informed design. Community feedback played an important role in shaping the project. Pre-construction engagement results showed over 90% of respondents would like a bike path along Bay Ridge Drive, 80% identified a lack of protected cycling infrastructure as a key barrier, and more than 84% indicated they would use off-road cycling facilities. Residents emphasized the need for greater separation from vehicle traffic, improved intersection safety, enhanced signage and education, and year-round maintenance, which were key considerations in the final design. The Bay Ridge Drive improvements support the city's commitment to giving people of all ages and abilities safer options to get around as Kingston grows. The corridor also represents a key segment of a future north-south route that will connect Creekford Road to Front Road and into downtown Kingston. In another message directly from the city this evening, an update on 315 Queen Mary Road shared care model opening. The City of Kingston is preparing to open 33 new transitional housing units as construction nears completion at the 315 Queen Mary Road site. In 2024, the City of Kingston purchased the former Extendicare building to develop an integrated model that brings together primary health care, transitional housing, and community-based programming focused on addressing the social determinants of health. This shared care model has three pillars: transitional supportive housing, primary health care clinic, and community use programming space. The primary health clinic is the Midtown Kingston Health Home, operated by Kingston Community Health Centers. It is now relocated to 315 Queen Mary Road. The operator of the transitional housing program at 315 Queen Mary Road is Home Based Housing. The program will provide transitional housing for individuals age 55 plus with varying levels of healthcare needs, supported by 24/7 on-site staff and a goal-based case management approach. The city expects Home Based Housing will welcome residents in August of 2026, following the completion of construction. The community space is confirmed to include a vocational laundry program operated by Lionhearts, where participants will gain practical experience while building the habits and self-assurance that lead to lasting employment. This program will be operational as of October 2026. The additional community use and programming space will be activated in early 2027. On July 7, 2026, City Council approved the incorporation of a new wellness health center within the community space at 315 Queen Mary Road to complement the other healthcare services on site. The Wellness Healthcare Center will focus on services such as respiratory rehabilitation, occupational therapy, physiotherapy, and hydrotherapy, amongst a number of wellness supports. The city is accepting applications for a community liaison committee for the site. The committee will ensure continued connection and dialogue between partner agencies and the surrounding community. Applications for the community liaison committee are open until August 9, 2026 on the Get Involved Kingston page. For more information or to submit an application for the Community Liaison Committee, visit the 315 Queen Mary Road Get Involved Kingston page, or contact by email, contact us at cityofkingston.ca, or by phone at 613-546-0000. In another message from the City of Kingston this week, five initiatives selected to receive funding support through the Rural Community Program Fund. The City of Kingston has announced the recipients of the 2026 Rural Community Program Fund, an annual investment in rural events and initiatives that foster community belonging, celebrate rural life and culture, and create opportunities for residents and visitors to experience rural Kingston. The five successful projects will receive up to $5,000 to support their initiatives. The five initiatives are Pearson Park Rink Redevelopment, Joyceville Rink Redevelopment Committee, Welfare Community Garden, Scott Ecological Fund, Sounds of the Pines Concert Series, Sand Hill Presbyterian Church, Five Stand Recreational Shooting Sport Experience, Kingston and District Trap Skeet and Sporting Clays Club, and Reusable Programming Equipment, Thousand Islands 4-H Sheep Club. Councillor Gary Osteroff says, quote, "Rural communities are an integral part of Kingston's identity, and this year's funded initiatives help bring neighbors together while celebrating the unique character of our rural areas. The passion and commitment of these organizations to create welcoming experiences for residents and visitors ensures our communities remain vibrant, connected, and resilient." To recognize this year's recipients and celebrate the value of rural programming, the city will host a community celebration on Friday, July 17th at Glen Burnie Fire Hall. Residents are invited to attend, learn more about the initiatives, and meet the organizers. The city extends its sincere thanks to the members of the Rural Kingston Working Group for their continued support, leadership, and guidance during the application process. Learn more about the Rural Community Development Fund and this year's funding recipients on Get Involved Kingston. Another exciting announcement this evening, new baseball diamond opens in Woodbine Park in partnership with Kingston Thunder Baseball and Jay's Care Foundation. City officials, community partners, and local baseball enthusiasts gathered at Woodbine Park last week to celebrate the official opening of the newly improved junior baseball diamond, made possible through a partnership with Jay's Care Foundation, the charitable arm of the Toronto Blue Jays. Mayor Brian Patterson joined members of City Council, representatives from the City of Kingston's Public Works, Special Events, Recreation, and Leisure Services Departments, Jay's Care Foundation, Kingston Thunder Baseball, TD Bank, and Taggart Construction for the ribbon-cutting ceremony and community celebration. Amy Elgarzma, Director of Recreation and Leisure Services for the City of Kingston, states, quote, "This project demonstrates the impact that strong community partnerships can have on local recreation opportunities. The improvements to this diamond will benefit young athletes and help support the continued growth of baseball in Kingston for years to come." The project was made possible through a significant investment in local baseball infrastructure. In 2023, Kingston Thunder Baseball was awarded $65,000 in funding from the Jay's Care Foundation through the Field of Dreams. made possible by TD Funding Program, to support major upgrades to the diamond. Improvements included new fencing, a backstop, player benches, land leveling, and new sod, transforming the field into a safer and more welcoming space for athletes and families. The city sends out a special thank you to Taggart Construction, whose support in the form of volunteer hours, financial contribution, and donated services helped build the diamond. The junior baseball field is located at Woodbine Park, 1184 Woodbine Road in Kingston. The Ontario Ministry of Education has announced that the Limestone District School Board will receive $21.4 million in funding for a new 407-student space elementary school in Kingston's West End. This exciting announcement was made on June 29th as the city and LDSB continue to plan for a new school and park space that will support growth in the Westbrook community while creating new opportunities for learning, recreation, and community connection. With funding now secured and as directed by City Council, the city and LDSB are continuing to work together on several key initiatives. Firstly, a potential equitable land exchange to support the development of a new elementary school at the current Westbrook Park site and a new municipal park at the current W.J. Holsgrove School site. Planning for the future municipal park will include public engagement through the city's established consultation processes. This will also include a community use agreement to support public access to school lands and amenities outside of school hours. As planning is still in the early stages, detailed timelines are not yet available. The city and LDSB will continue working together over the coming months to confirm project details and will host a community drop-in information session this fall. Information about the session, including the date and location, will be shared on Get Involved Kingston as it becomes available. If you have any questions or feedback to share ahead of the meeting, please share them on Get Involved Kingston or email the city at getinvolvedkingston@cityofkingston.ca. One final message from the city this evening. This Emancipation Day, the city of Kingston is calling on all residents to remember and honor those who fought to end slavery across the British Empire, to reflect on the ongoing struggle for equality, and to continue the work of dismantling racial discrimination in Canada. To mark Emancipation Day on Saturday, August 1st, the city of Kingston is hosting a flag-raising ceremony and event at 12:30 p.m., followed by a community art exhibition at 1:30 p.m. at Confederation Park, across from Kingston City Hall. The flag-raising ceremony includes song performances, a youth tribute, and a keynote address. Speaking on the theme, Honoring the Past, Empowering the Future, the keynote connects the history and legacy of emancipation to present-day commitments and collective responsibility. The community art exhibition will feature interactive displays exploring themes of resistance, freedom, and healing, along with artifacts that highlight the joy, strength, resilience, and achievements of African civilizations over thousands of years. Food vendors will also offer Nigerian, Haitian, and other cuisines. The Kingston Frontenac Public Library will also host a kids' zone with family-friendly activities, including Freedom Flag coloring, bracelet making, and a story corner featuring books by Black Canadian authors. Sua Osman, IIDEA advisor with the City of Kingston, says, quote, "Emancipation Day is an important opportunity to recognize the strength, resilience, and contributions of Black communities, while also acknowledging the lasting impacts of slavery and anti-Black racism that continue to shape experiences today. While we take some time to reflect on the significance of August 1st and honor those who fought for freedom and justice, the work does not stop here. Building inclusive, equitable, and welcoming communities requires ongoing commitment, meaningful action, and accountability throughout the year. Emancipation Day is free to attend and everyone is welcome. Learn more about Emancipation Day on the city's website. Before we wrap up this evening, I'm going to run through your weekend forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer to finish off your week. If you're heading out after tonight's show, you can test your knowledge with music trivia at Something in the Water Brewing and trivia at Riverhead Brewing or Spearhead Brewing, all starting at 7 p.m. If you want a more chill evening, Movies in the Square kicks off at dusk tonight with Guardians in the Galaxy playing at Springer Market Square. You can keep the night going with karaoke at the Buckle beginning at 9, or check out the weekly urban music social at La Vida Bistro starting at 9:30. On Friday, for free drop-in practice, you can join the Spanish conversation sessions hosted at the Sydenham Street Commons from 12:30 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. Friday evening brings Kickin' It Country to the City Hall Amphitheater from 7 to 8 p.m., featuring live performances from local country artists, so dust off your boots and enjoy some free live music downtown. You can wrap up Friday with karaoke at Jersey starting at 8:30, or at The Buckle and Deft Brewing starting at 9. Saturday starts with the Kingston Public Market at Springer Market Square from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m., featuring local farmers, makers, and artisans. The Mini Market Series, a bi-weekly market featuring rotating local artisans, makers, and handmade goods, takes place in the Sydenham Street Commons from 10 to 5 p.m. At 11 a.m., you can catch local chef demos at the City Hall Amphitheater. At 12:30, enjoy free live music from Saturday Sessions in Confederation Park, showcasing a variety of local musicians. In the evening, line dancing returns to The Buckle from 7 to 8 p.m. Sunday begins with the Memorial Center Farmers Market from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And at 10 a.m., you can enjoy some yoga in Battery Park. If you don't want the weekend to end too soon, you can wind down with karaoke at both The Merchant and The Toucan beginning at 9 p.m. That wraps up your weekend forecast. Once again, that was just some of the events and concerts coming up this weekend in the region. Be sure to head to CFRC.ca for our full events and concerts listings, curated by CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny Hinch. If you have an event or concert that you'd like to add to our online or on-air calendars, reach out today via CFRC.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. To revisit episodes and listen on the go, head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present back to you Royer's second single off his upcoming album, Charlatan. This song explores the story of someone who is on the run to escape their fate. No matter how far away this person is hiding, they always gravitate home. Check out the CFRC archives for our conversation with Chris Royer about his new music from June 18th via CFRC.ca. If you're a local artist looking for airplay and social media promotion, be sure to complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via Visit Kingston.music on Instagram today. In the meantime, stream Back to You by Royer on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
In my mind, everything's fine. I'll be all right. Lord knows I tried. The radio says, dead or alive, 5,000 died. As reason why, lay me down. This train is barking off the tracks. Throttle break down, no turning back. Running, running, running out of the blue. Running, running, running back to you.
To Kingston Real Estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Today on Wings, historian and archivist Max Dashew speaks on rape culture in Western civilization.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Max Dashew collects and analyzes texts and images from world cultures to learn what women have done and what's been done to women. Her new book, Women in Greek Mythography, exposes the role of rape in hero narratives that underlie Western culture today. Here's interviewer Mindy Ran.
What made you want to start looking at this as a subject? Is it something that just became glaringly obvious to you as you were building the archives?
Before, because I could see when I was in high school that I was living in a male-dominated society. My best friend told me about another girl whose boyfriend was, you know, a basketball king in this little town. It was a date rape. He forced her. And she was ashamed, and she was terrified she would get pregnant, and there was nothing she could do. Nobody would listen to her. I mean, back in 1967, whenever it was, there was no remedy. It was just all on her, her trauma. He could get away with that. And we know date rape like that still happens. There had to be a discourse about it, but back then, nothing. And so I knew from my own life and other things that I saw going on around me that there was a profound injustice toward women and a tremendous amount of male violence against women. So the reason for my whole undertaking of the research I've done on major cultures and also on patriarchal violence and systems is to understand, how did this come to be? How did it get accepted to such a degree that it became the law, custom, that it became the norm? Stories that are told about rape encode these values.
Is there a start to rape culture?
I think there must have been. We can't know that going so far back in time, but patriarchy is not one timeline. We have different start points in different parts of the world, and we're all kind of vaguely trying to guess where this happened and when this happened. You have major cultural societies that even survive up to these days, but like just take the European world conquest fanning out from the 1400s. The earliest evidence that we have comes from law codes, and there you do see these very patriarchal and class-based parameters over how rape is treated. In my research, it's been very difficult because there has not been an integrated historical narrative about laws around rape or any other set of patriarchal laws. You know, it has not been systematized in that way. You have to go in there yourself and dig out through each cultural record, whatever literature you can get your hands on. And they might not talk about that at all, even if it's a study of, you know, law in Morocco, because it has been sequestrated. It's hidden. And it's not seen as a priority, or it's seen as shameful, but it's something not to be talked about. Therefore, we don't have a clear picture yet. In the last 50 years, especially, I think a body of scholarship has begun of women trying to track cultural norms around systemic violence against women. But I don't think we're there yet.
How do you define rape culture?
A systematic projection of patriarchal domination on the way that rape is talked about, mythologized, all these cultural narratives that are just sort of the wallpaper, both in ancient times and also in our current late capitalist patriarchy, where there's excusing rape, euphemizing rape, blaming the victim. And in my book, Women in Greek Mythography, where I'm talking about stories, it's a framework. The gods are all rapists. And the heroes are rapists, too. So the main figures who are being presented and valorized by the society as the models, that which is sacred, that which is admirable, that which is heroic, they commit rape. And it's not even presented as a bad thing. It's just how it is. And there can be no criticism of the rapist in these stories. They are the heroes and the gods. So we all get taught Greek mythology. And both in the ancient sources and also the modern commentaries, they are euphemizing it. So even though the story is a rape story, it's being described in terms that Zeus fell in love with so-and-so or Apollo loved so-and-so. It's kind of a bait and switch because there's a rape going on and everybody can see that this is a rape. But at the same time, it's being described in terms that minimize it. You know, it's not really what's happening. There's something else happening because they're on the side of the rapist. That's basically the perspective. The storyteller, whether it's Homer or any of the other writers, are excusing it. And it's not that bad. Actually, good things are coming out of it because this is how the founder of this dynasty or that dynasty, that's where he comes from, is this maiden who was raped by Zeus or Apollo or whoever it may be. So when a culture backs up rape in that way, it makes girls and women feel like no one is on my side. You know, and there are also a lot of stories about girls who are punished for having been raped, especially by their own fathers. There's loads of Greek myths like this. And so the father will kill her, and there's a taboo on shedding the blood of kin. So what they will do is they will bury her alive. They will confine her in an underground chamber. They will drown her or any other form of murder that does not involve actually slicing her open.
You say that they're portrayed and presented as Zeus loved so-and-so. Right. How do you know they're talking about rape? Is it described in a way that makes it obvious it's rape?
Yeah, usually. She's unwilling. She runs away, but he catches her. He overcomes her. This teaches a cultural value that rape is any way connected to love. He loved her, like Zeus loved so-and-so. You know, he fell in love with her. It's the idea that lust is the same as love and that coercion could ever be involved in love. It's what he wants, and her desire and her will are completely irrelevant in the story.
In these stories, these maidens are all unwilling. Yeah. So this is this clear telling of a rape as opposed to a romantic story.
Right. So here's how to clarify that. Sometimes we have multiple versions of the story. There's no ambiguity. They all have the same basic thrust in the story. Excuse the expression. Some storytellers will minimize it. And this goes both for ancients and moderns. And so, for example, Robert Graves, in a story that's a known rape story, will instead replace raped with seduced or ravished her. And then in one story, he's talking about Zeus raping his own mother, Rhea. And Graves says, it was then that he began his long series of adventures in love. So this is the kind of rewrite. I think the ancients are much more comfortable with just, yeah, you know, he ravished her, you know, he carried her off. She was forced. And the moderns are much more given to the euphemism, you know, because they're attached to these stories. And one of the things that happens is that because Hellenic civilization becomes the model for modern Western civ, this is all admired. It is something to be praised and followed. So they're very reluctant to really uncover what's happening here. And they constantly are putting these euphemisms, describing it in terms other than what they know is there. So that there's a cognitive dissonance for the female reader. because you're seeing this. And the same goes, by the way, for the vase paintings. That, you know, she's running away. They never show the actual rape, but they will show the woman running or him grabbing her and carrying her off. And she's throwing up her arms to heaven, and nobody ever comes to her aid, of course. But there was a taboo on actually showing the rape. But in this very popular ceramic painting market, the demand side wanted those images. And that's rape culture. It's in poetry, it's in drama, it's in painting, it's in sculpture. And then this all gets picked up again in the Renaissance, the Baroque, the Romantic painters of modern times. So there's an endorsement in it that's implicit. Of course, well, you know, Romulus and Remus, they raped the Sabine women. And of course, we don't really approve of that, but we're going to just lovingly lavish much time and many, many paintings on showing this.
So you're saying that this was hidden in language and euphemism.
Yes. They don't even have a word for rape in ancient Greek. It's covered by hubris, which means overreaching out of arrogance, or bio, which means violence, but they don't have a specific word for rape. Now, our word for rape comes from Latin, raptus, which does not actually describe the act of rape as we understand it. It refers to carrying a woman off, refers to forcible abduction, and everybody knows what comes after that. One of the famous stories of rape in the Iliad is that the Trojan princess Cassandra, Troy, has fallen against all her prophecies. No one listened to her. And so she runs to the Palladion statue of Athena, and she wraps her arms around it and takes refuge there. And then, desecrating the sanctuary, in come the Greek warriors, and Ajax grabs her and rapes her. So again, he's never actually shown raping her, but what the artists do instead is they show her half naked, with her clothes falling off of her already, even before he's reached her. Or even sometimes they show her naked and with her legs apart. So they're telegraphing the message. And again, this is about the male gaze. You know, she's about to get raped. His violence is not shown at its worst. And this was a very popular topic. Another aspect to this, you have rape of a woman being a story that has to do with the colonization of a foreign country. And so when Apollo rapes Kyrene, and she's actually a Greek maiden who is, she's kind of a butch. She doesn't do women's work. She goes out and herds her father's sheep. She fights off a lion. In one story, she actually wrestles the lion. So she's no pushover. But of course, who can fight a god? And so Apollo comes along and abducts her and carries her off to Libya. And so this is where the name of the city, Cyrene, and the modern province, Cyrenaica, comes from. It was colonized by the Greeks. And Apollo then takes the children he has engendered on her, and he takes them away from her as well. He's really good at robbing women in every possible way. But Apollo becomes the god of colonization. And so you have this fusion of those two themes. And this is something that you can see in a lot of discussions of conquest as rape, and the role of rape in conquest as part of the subjugation of the entire people. So that's an interesting thing. This is where, kind of intersectionally, we can see this relationship between male domination and colonization. Demoralization and subjugation are really basic to a successful conquest. Even when a war is not going on, rape is symbolic and actually a war on women within the society itself. And so then the question becomes, which women are fair game? There are stories in Greek mythology of brothers who rape their sisters, and then the sister is blamed and cast out because the son is too valuable, but girls are what, they're nothing. And she's shamed the family now, so she has to be punished and show the world that we still have our honor, that twisted sense of honor. Common women are assumed to be a whorish class by aristocratic men. Because they are not covered and secluded in Greek society as the citizen class women are, or the aristocratic women, they are considered already to be sexually available. And covering is, in many patriarchal cultures, a very important sign. This woman is taken. She has a male protector. She is a decent woman. But then the majority of women really in this society are defined as fair game. We can see this in medieval Europe, you know, the rape of peasant women by feudal lords. We can see it certainly in the racialized slavery, caste slavery of the Americas, where there was no defense against a white man who raped a black woman, or for that matter, who raped a native woman. And that goes back to our theme of conquest of an entire ethnicity or group of ethnicities. You know, really, there's a way in which we could define this as male privilege. In Greek culture, they literally had hero worship. There were shrines. They did ceremonies. They made offerings to the heroes. So Heracles, Theseus, Achilles, Perseus, they are founders, the founder of Athens, the founder of Mycenae, the founder of various dynasties. They're all rapists and they're conquerors. Also, they're fighting monsters who are often female. The Gorgon, of course, is the most iconic of all the female monsters, and the slicing off of the Gorgon's head. The Gorgon is a protective icon. You know, this is why Gorgon heads appear on temples. She isn't a demon. She wards off danger and negative energy and illness. Having the male heroes constantly confronting and slaughtering these figures also has a valence, you know, and the message is we're on the side of the male hero. And of course, we're all against the monstrous demonic female. There's also the hero as rescuer of the endangered female. This is a theme in our cartoons in the 60s. So thousands of years later, people are still reading this literature, this great literature that glorifies these actions. And that message gets carried along. You know, it's very subliminal because most people don't read it and see at face value what's happening.
On Wings, historian and archaeomythologist Max Dashew discusses rape culture. The interviewer is Mindy Rann.
One of the aspects that you mentioned was that these stories not only teach us the hero worship, but they also teach the women that there is no point in fighting against this.
Yes. And that's back to this theme of demoralization. It cannot be thinkable that you should resist. And resistance is pointless. And the other thing is that in the stories, also other women do not act. There's very little female solidarity. So, for example, in the Agamemnon, he drags Cassandra back as his sex slave to Mycenae, where he is king. And his wife is not happy about having this enslaved concubine brought into the household. And she kills Agamemnon, but she also kills Cassandra. And this division of women through marriage, slavery, captivity is something that is pervasive in patriarchy.
Is that the purpose of the retelling of these stories?
I think the purpose is to gratify men's self-regard, their sexual fantasies, the idea of domination, which, you know, these narratives are very much all about. I don't think that they thought of themselves as trying to propagate a particular social order that they already saw as a given.
Do you believe that this is part of what cements modern rape culture? Where is the line there?
Yeah, I don't think there is a line. Patriarchy is like a set of accretions, layer upon layer upon layer, that become naturalized. They become part of the fabric of culture and they get carried along. Even, you know, the empire falls, another takes its place. But these stories, not always, but in this case, they got passed on and they become models. So the retelling of these stories is something that was brought forward to the threshold of U.S. society. This was part of education. This is how you were taught. You had to learn these stories and value them and praise them. But then I would say at an even deeper level, the model of the lady killer hero, who is like James Bond is a great example, a secret agent, right? Constantly shooting and fighting his way through everything with a woman on each arm you know, and periodically taking time off to have a couple of cocktails and a sexual affair. This model of manhood is just massively pervasive, and you have all of the action movies, and you have others too, like John Wayne. And so you've got the Indian fighter. You know, genocide is the background, but it's not being spoken about that way. He's the hero. So where is the cultural admiration placed? It's with the dominator and the conqueror. So the clan leaders in Birth of a Nation, they're the heroes. They're the ones who are rescuing, mythically, white women from the mythical black rapist, cartoonishly portrayed. And, you know, we could just go on and on with Tarzan, Lawrence of Arabia, Dirty Harry. There are all these different, the Terminator, the Godfather. The hero can be very violent, and it doesn't seem to be a problem for people as long as he's defined as being on the good side. But that also takes us back into the racialized side of this, because it's very non-coincidental that in U.S. filmmaking, at different epochs, you know, you will have the anti-hero, the villain, will be a Palestinian or some Arab person. So the whole terrorism narrative, foreign policy, is actually being projected. And, of course, the racialized themes also of, you know, black gangsters and all of these portrayals that have occasioned protest from the affected communities. And, of course, from women who pretty much universally through Hollywood have been dealt with very badly. The use of sexual violence or just even sexual objectification and the butt shots and all of that as a natural medium of how film is expected to be, that's still the case. So I think that we're still dealing with hero worship.
How is that portrayed in modern day culture?
Oh. Well, I think the sexualization of rape is something that is massively pervasive in porn, and that is the biggest publishing industry in modern society by far. You know, and we're talking mass media, not only writing, but in film and video. So gonzo porn, not just rape, but torture and mutilation and femicide, that's hugely being consumed. And it's sort of the modern parallel to those Greek vases, but in a much more specific and violent way.
Can you define gonzo porn?
It's porn that is not just about sexual relations, but involves degradation. You know, the more extreme, the better, as far as the consumers are concerned, sticking women's heads in toilets and, you know, holding them under or forcing them to eat disgusting things, battery, torture, actual torture. And, you know, need I not explain that in order to create this, this involves doing this to an actual woman or child in many cases. That to film this, it's actually happening to someone, that the rape is real. That's the film is of a rape.
Is this getting worse?
I think it's getting worse because the explicitness of rape culture, and this is the aforementioned gonzo porn. There was some pornography that was like very niche and maybe collectors, very hard to find, that was very violent against women. A lot of it was much more implicit. But, you know, from the Playboy days, things, it got a lot raunchier and a lot more explicit rape culture through Hustler. But then it all exploded with video. And the gonzo porn is just so, so violent. And the thing is, it's not anymore only reaching adult male consumers. It's kids who can get it on their phones, you know, and do and share it around and imitate it. They actually do try to act it out on their girlfriends, or maybe not even a girlfriend, but some girl that they have access to, you know. So you have all these, you know, back page media stories in the, no, they're not really newspapers anymore, but you see reports of, you know, some 13-year-old boy in India raped his older sister based on, you know, some porn film he saw. You know, so these things are being acted out. And I think that goes for adult men also. And the women in the sex industry testified to this. And if they don't want to do it, then they're going to meet with violence. I don't think we can separate the symbolism and the cultural representation of male violence against women as a story, as a video, as a book, as an ad, like all the advertising that showed models with, you know, bruises on their faces and this kind of stuff. You can't separate the symbolism and the stories from what actually goes on, or even from the expectations. You know, so one of the things that's happened, and this was not true in my youth, but girls now are expected that sex, having sex with their boyfriend, the boyfriend thinks that slapping and choking her is fine. That's what sex is. That is what the gonzo porn has shown them. It has succeeded in redefining and socializing what sexuality is to an entire generation.
What can we do about this? How do we combat it? Is it solidarity? Is it getting the men to stand up? What is it that we need to do to finally start knocking holes in rape culture?
I think raising awareness is the first step. We have to actually be shining a light on what's going on and the way that it works and the way that it kind of get waved off. It's like, this is just this artist's point of view and everybody gets to have their point of view, because no, it's endemic and it's pervasive. And so we have to start speaking against it. And it's helpful if men will speak against it too, but really it is for women or for rape survivors themselves to be foregrounded in this and have those perspectives brought forward. You know, and I think that there needs to be a much more critical view of in how mass media is feeding this back to all of us. Once we can build a consensus that this is harmful, then we will be able to change it.
It's up to us as individuals and collectively as communities to speak up and speak out, I'm hearing.
Yeah. And it's not only that, but it's important to do that, because I think we went through a period like in the 70s and 80s where it was a huge outcry. We also had Me Too movement happen. But then what tends to happen is the culture tends to drop it. It gets ground down. A lot of men don't want to hear it. A lot of women feel uncomfortable about it. They don't want to have controversy. They just want to kind of like ignore it and hope it goes away. But guess what? It doesn't go away. So more of a united front is required. And, you know, really that goes for the absolute reality, which is the impunity of rape is the dominant reality and has been for centuries. But, you know, supposedly feminism happened. A lot of women think everything was fixed, but sexual violence is as bad as ever. And even in the countries that are rated the highest in terms of women's standing in Scandinavia, like the Icelanders and Norway, the sexual violence rates are quite high. So that is in many ways the ultimate frontier of feminist struggle, because that is something that is the most impervious to change. I mean, I don't want to leave this on a negative note. Like, oh, the topic is very heavy, but I think it's just really crucial for all of human society to overcome this expectation that rape is natural, men can't help it, and the kind of collusion that's built in, including by the stories that we tell or hear, and the representations, the visual representations especially, that condition everyone to think that's just how it is. It doesn't have to be that way.
Max Dashew's new book is Women in Greek Mythography. She also hosts a related video on YouTube. To find her vast collection of images, videos, and courses online, visit suppressedhistories.net. Wings thanks Mindy Wren for today's interview. Thanks also to your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Since the day I stopped drinking, my life has gotten better and better. I can't take any credit for it. It just seems that without alcohol, I think better, I'm more careful with money, I watch what I say, I don't get into trouble like I did when I was drinking. It's scary trying to walk through life alone, and today I have that very distinct feeling that I don't ever have to be alone again.
Visit AA.org